Hello, welcome to the April edition of Black Book Talk on KBOO. We have the pleasure of talking to a penetrating author, Ralph Remington. His book, Penetrating Whiteness: How White Supremacy Built America, is a bomb. Now, when I talk about bombing, I'm not talking about going over to other people's country and dropping bombs on them. I'm talking about opening up their minds with knowledge. How are you doing, Ralph?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Why don't you give us just a small passage from the book so people will understand what we're talking about?
All right. Start out with a piece called Exile. I was born in exile, wanted by no one, belonging nowhere. My life has been a quest to belong while owning some sense of dignity and respect, and in belonging to somehow find meaning. So I have consistently interrogated my own identity and the environment that shaped it. However, today in this American moment, I am lost and alas, still in exile. I didn't know the world that I was coming into. Some say that we choose the lifetimes that we will lead. I don't know. It's complicated. I would have chosen a world without religion or divisions of race or gender or sexual orientation or class. I would have chosen a world where we could be with who we wanted to be with physically and spiritually without societal taboos. Instead, I found a world where we walk in lockstep, behaving according to societal norms and entirely afraid to disrupt the status quo. We are a nation and a world of cowards. Enter Donald Trump. He knew that we were a nation of cowards, so it was very easy for him to bully his way to the presidency of the United States and to tromp all over civility on the way there. We were so married to the rules of decorum that we couldn't realize when an enemy of the people was truly among us. Our collective marriage to etiquette killed America.
Good morning, Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman.
Hello.
This is Patricia Welch.
Hello.
That was a great beginning for this show. When I first saw the title, Penetrating Whiteness, I thought, wonder what that means. I kept thinking, maybe it means to get into whiteness. What made you choose the title?
Whiteness itself is penetrating. It penetrates the minds of everyone and everything in America. So whiteness is penetrating, whether we like it or not. We are in a white world in the United States of America. It's been created by colonizers that the sole purpose was penetration. They penetrated the continent when they killed thousands and thousands and millions of native peoples that lived here. They penetrated our consciousness. They penetrated everything about who we are. Black people have penetrated whiteness because our very culture penetrates whiteness itself. Our culture is antithetical to all that whiteness is. Whiteness was set up to be antithetical to us, but ironically, we are antithetical to it as well. And we brought our contributions from different places and brought it here to the United States of America to create the culture that we now have. Could we imagine a world without blues and country and rock and roll and jazz and hip hop? Could we imagine a world like that? We couldn't. And that comes with us. Can we imagine a world without yams and collard greens and peanut butter? No, that comes with us. And so we penetrated whiteness in that way and so many others.
Were these essays, were they published separately and then you collected them, or what? How did this come about?
That's a great question. I was a city council member in the city of Minneapolis between 2006 and 2009 for 4 years. And I was a columnist for a black newspaper there, the Minnesota Spokesman Recorder. And I wrote a regular column for their paper. And so some of the essays came from that. Some essays, I just write essays for fun for myself and I file them. Some essays come from social media posts that I've done, and many essays were created specifically for the book.
Well, whose idea was it to go back and collect and place all these together? I mean, did you intend to write a book?
That's a great question. I always thought I would write a book, but during the pandemic, I was reading Baldwin's The Price of the Ticket and his collected works, and I thought, well, I have poetry and I have essays and I have all of these things that I've written over the years that speak about very similar topics that Baldwin addressed in his day. Maybe this would be of interest to someone if I aggregated them and put them together into a collection. So I did, and I pitched it to an editor at the San Francisco Writers Conference, and my editor, Brenda Knight, and she said, let me see it. And the next day she wrote me back and said, this is important, we need to talk. And that's how it started.
And as you were getting ready to publish, who was your intended audience?
So I started out as an actor and a playwright. I typically don't write with an audience in mind. I write with something I have to say, or something I have to say. And it's almost like if I don't get it out, then it will destroy me. I don't write towards an audience because I'm not a commercial writer. I think commercial writers do. They have to. If you want to sell lots of books in airports, that's what you do. You find out what your audience is and you write to them. And so for me, I was writing, because I needed to write. And obviously, I'm Black American, so I'm writing for Black people all the time. But I'm definitely also writing for white people. And hopefully that white people that can receive the information properly, hopefully it will help them on their journey to understanding or becoming anti-racist, and trying to understand this reality that we all exist in together. I know that it's only for a certain group of white people because it's not for MAGA, because MAGA is not trying to hear what I have to say, and I don't necessarily know if they'd appreciate what I have to say. They couldn't receive it. But people that are on the fence, that consider themselves moderate, people that are maybe teeter-tottering one way or the other, they don't know what their political or racial analysis is yet. Those are the people that are the book is intended for. A lot of young people, young white folks, definitely receive it in a way that probably it's best intended. I think that since George Floyd, that audience has gotten bigger.
At one point in the book, you said you think that white women are the key to paraphrase it, but are the key to defeating white supremacy, and I wanted to know why and how.
Yeah, that's a great question. I'll start out to say I think white women are the gardeners of white supremacy. They keep white supremacy going. Through PTA meetings, election boards, any community group, any book club, any official position, white women are the ones that kind of keep pushing the white supremacy narrative because that's where their security lies. But we have to go back to the beginning historically. How did this nation get created and how did whiteness get created? And the one drop rule and all of those things. And that was all about white male dominion over white women's wombs. They didn't care about Black and brown women. They don't care about Black and brown people at all, but they cared about maintaining and supporting whiteness. And you can only have whiteness if white women are not allowed to be with any people of color sexually and to have children with those people of color. If they were allowed to do that, then white people would have ceased to exist. Black women have been with white men forcibly more often than not because of our history of slavery in the United States of America. That's why we look the way we look. That's why we are the way we are. We're not purely from Africa. To be Black in America is to be African, indigenous, European. That's what primarily makes of Black people in America, and the same as in all of the Americas, whether it's Central America, South America, that's our mixture. That's who we are. We're not African. We are the Americas. And the Americas came out of colonization, it came out of slavery. And that's how we were created. The only difference between us and South Americans and Central Americans was the language of our colonizers. Ours were British, theirs were Spanish and Portuguese. That's it. And so white folks knew that in order to maintain white supremacy, they had to keep white women on lock. The minute that you disrupt the way white women think of themselves, the way that they help maintain white supremacy, then they disrupt the whole apple cart. Keep in mind, white women didn't vote for Hillary. They didn't vote for Obama en masse. White people in general supported the Republican Party. And so that's why Trump is in. If white women had voted for Kamala en masse, Kamala would have won. If white women had voted for Hillary en masse, Hillary would have won. But they didn't. They voted for white supremacy. So the key to the whole thing is disrupting the way that white women think of themselves in this thing that we call the United States of America.
You mentioned the differentiation in living conditions and where we live. I thought that was very interesting. You talk about where people lived, the type of schools they go to, the difference between inner city schooling as opposed to suburban education and politics.
Well, I mean, I think that in general, suburbia was, built on trying to isolate white people from the unwashed masses, That's why the freeways were built the way they were and mowed down black neighborhoods to get white people from work to home as quickly as possible without having ever encountered a black face. And that's why suburbia was created and how suburbia was created. It's like you need to go into the city to get that job. We need you to fly through in a freeway and fly back home on a freeway and never meet or see a black person at all. Where, black people, we have to have facility with white people in order for us to even get any kind of economic foothold in what we call the United States of America. We don't have the luxury of being isolated from them. We have to interact because they hold the keys to commerce. But they don't have to have a vocabulary or ever have to develop any kind of cultural competency in regards to Black America.
In your essay about Bernie Sanders, you
Yes.
talk about why we'll never see Bernie Sanders as the leader of our country, as the president, because our society would never accept it. Could you talk a little about that?
Yeah, the Bernie Sanders. I go as you read the book, you see my evolution and kind of talking about Bernie from the beginning when he was first running, and then to his later campaigns and kind of how he kind of situated himself. I think that the United States was not meant to accommodate us a socialist, a socialist Democrat. That's not what the United States was not built for that. And the minute that they see that happening, I think that was frankly why MLK was killed. Because as long as MLK was talking just strictly about racial accommodation, he was a threat, but it was fine. But when he started talking about redistribution of the wealth, and when he started talking about we don't need poor people when we have, the ultra rich. And when you started talking against the military industrial complex, that's when King was snuffed out. And so anything that disrupts the way we distribute wealth in this society, usually the rich won't have it. Now, what I would say now, today, because we do have a billionaire in charge of things, and we see how just lovely things are going, How lovely things are today. I think that we're right for someone like AOC to come in and gain a foothold and perhaps become president of the United States. I think that could happen. I would love to see a Kamala AOC ticket. And people talk about, they think that misogyny is so baked in that it'll never happen. It's like, well, that's what they said about race. You know, who would have thought we would have seen a black man become president before a white woman? I had that bet for years that a white woman would be president first before a black man, and who knew, right? And so we're capable of anything. You know, we just have to believe and put the people power behind it.
As you and the rest of the world were looking at television and seeing what was happening in Portland during the pandemic, and you said something like about white people and losing their mind. It was some line that reminded me of something my mother might say, but how the world was going crazy, how they were marching because they perceived they were losing some minute privilege to be out in the world during this time. Would you say something about that?
I think, in general, I just think that the pandemic for white people, I think they thought that they were losing something because they could typically go anywhere, say anything, be anything, show up any way they wanted to, and no one would ever say anything about it, and because they had free agency to do whatever they wanted at any time. And so to have these restrictions on them was a restriction on whiteness itself in the way that they viewed it. And for me, the pandemic was a break from white supremacy. So I loved it. I loved being at home by myself. I loved like not having to sit in a meeting and watch white people roll their eyes when I say something that they didn't agree with, or having a sec or second guessing something, some data I came up with, or all the daily microaggressions that you go through in when you deal with white America as a black person. For me, it was a break from white supremacy to not have to deal with that every day. I just see them on the screen, click off, and I'm in my own head. And it actually was measured because my blood pressure dropped like 15 points during the pandemic. My blood pressure dropped. And I thought, man, my blood pressure is much lower. And then I realized, oh, that's because I'm on a break from white supremacy.
I love that BLM, the Black Lives Matter protest here in Portland, gave me a lot of chuckles because my son would go out in the evenings and check on the protests, and he would come back and report to me, yeah, they had signs that said Black Lives Matter, but not a black person was in the group.
I know we talked about Portland. When I love Portland, by the way. I will self I will, preface it to say that I love Portland, and for a lot of reasons. But I love Powell's Bookstore. But I do love Portland. With most of these white places, white spaces, San Francisco included. They're, they profess themselves to be progressive, so it's harder to see the out and out racism unless you look closely or you feel it on a day-to-day basis. If you fly in and out of someplace on a visit, you might not catch it, but if you live it day to day in that place, you will know it. And Path to Smiles. And when I was in Portland, I just say I but. So this is a piece, Racism in Portlandia. I just returned from a work trip in Portland to Portlandia. I love Portland, but I thought that I'd comment on an experience that I had at the Doug Fir, a little hipster bar connected to the Jupiter Hotel. So I popped into the bar a couple of nights ago to grab a whiskey. A bearded hipster dude, I subsequently found out his name was Justin, was tending the bar. We made eye contact. I sat down and it wasn't packed yet. I waited while hipster dude kept waiting on white folks who had just walked in. He even solicited all manner of white folks, especially 20-something white women in skimpy clothes, to see if they wanted a drink. I'm still waiting. No service. Even the young white woman sitting on the stool next to me tried to gesture on my behalf. Finally, I said, "Hey, I've been waiting for service." He takes my order and then asks me if I want a big cube for a dollar extra. I say no. Doesn't make sense to me. He pours my drink, sets it down without a napkin. Everyone else got a napkin, of course. I drank and tabbed out. Next evening, I go to the bar again. A different bartender asked if I wanted a big cube. I said, "For a dollar extra? No thanks." He said, "What?" I told him what happened. He said, "That's bullshit. It doesn't cost extra. I'm the only black guy in the bar. Just another day of microaggressions in black life in America." Dude was actually charging me a black tax.
All right, we are coming to the close of this much too short interview, but I realize we really can't close without telling you a little bit more about our author. I mean, this is the Renaissance man. I just wrote down some of his titles: author, poet, actor, elected official, arts administrator, arts institution founder, playwright. I think the one that just, I don't know why, brought me the greatest pleasure was that you were a member of the International Brotherhood of Teachers. I know
Yeah.
you does not come from that background, but you have been the Director of Cultural Affairs for the San Francisco Arts Commission, Deputy Director of Arts and Culture for the City of Tempe, Western Regional Director, Assistant Executive Director of Actors Equity, the Director of Theater and Musical Theater for the National Endowment for the Arts, and it goes on. And yet, in the book, there's a chapter that I think it starts with, "Should I stay or should I go?" I would like you to read a poem that was written for your father in the wake of your father's death, because I think that answers all the questions and puts all of this in perspective. And really, I just think it's a lovely piece. So could you share this with us, please?
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you so much, Patricia. Piece is called Freedom from Being Black. As many of you know, my father passed away earlier this year at 80 years old. As tough as that was and is, it has provided me with a bit of perspective. He was a bold thinker and artist who laid the path that I tried to follow. The one thing that I think about over and over again is that he is finally free from being black. And now he knows the answers to everything. That may sound like an odd thing to say, for I am as proud of being black as any black person could be from a cultural perspective, an unapologetic card-carrying member of the African diaspora. But the blackness that I'm speaking about is from a pejorative perspective. To be black in this world, in this country, is to bear the burden of criminality and villainy for the entire human species. Black has been used as a word for denigration for our entire lives. It's a black day, a bad day. She's in a dark or black mood, a bad mood. Call a spade a spade. Even in the game of pool, the white ball is used to knock all of the balls of color off the table, and the game is finally won when the white ball knocks the black eight ball clean off the table, leaving the white cue ball the lone victor standing. I was in Minnesota, my favorite state in the nation, this summer, attending an Americans for the Arts Conference in Minneapolis. I stayed at the Hilton downtown during the conference. Afterwards, I stayed at an airport Super 8 in Bloomington for a couple of nights before my flight back to Arizona. When I checked into the Super 8, I asked the desk manager if they were holding funds on my credit card because I thought that I overheard her telling that to another guest. She looked at me as if I stole something and barked, "Read the sign." I said, "Excuse me, have I done something wrong?" Then, in short order, she told me that she was calling the police. She called the police. I had already paid my bill in advance, and she commenced to telling them that a black man was inappropriately recording her. I was recording because Hotel Becky decided to send a brother to jail simply for asking a question while checking into a motel. Long story short, Becky didn't want to go on the internet, and I didn't want the drama, so I de-escalated the situation, and Becky apologized. That trauma, however, still lives somewhere inside of me. My father is free from all of that. My father is free of the burden of driving down a street and seeing a car pull behind him with the headlights off, riding on his bumper, and all of a sudden the headlights are turned on along with flashing blue and red lights. My father is free from store clerks running up to him urgently as if in an emergency to ask if he needs help, simply out of fear that he might steal something. My father is free from wondering if he didn't get a job because he is black. My father is free from suppressing his rage when white folks roll their eyes in meetings and ridicule him with their silence simply because they disagreed with him, or maybe just because he attempted to be present. My father is free from being talked over and ignored in conversation. And even if he poses a question to a white person, having that white person deliver the answer to the nearest white person in the vicinity without even giving him the respect of looking him in the eye. My father is free from educating people about race, who in any event have all of the knowledge that they'd ever want on the internet if they even gave them. And let's be honest, the education isn't really about race, it's about whiteness and the construct of white supremacy in the United States of America. My father is free from worrying about making white folks feel guilty simply because he's in the room with them. My father is free from having to check his anger. My father is free from representing every single black person who has ever been born. My father is free from having to check his grammar. My father is free from monitoring his tone. My father is free from having to explain himself. My father is free from current and epigenetic trauma. My father is free from historical pain. My father doesn't have to worry about white racial comfort. My father is free from being constricted, restricted, constrained, watered down, patronized, abused, misused, and misunderstood. As E.E. Cummings once wrote, "To be nobody but yourself in a world which is doing its best night and day to make you like everybody else means to fight the hardest battle which any human being can fight and never stop fighting." I don't know how we all ended up in this place together, and I certainly don't know how this thing is going to end. But what I do know is that as a Black man and as a human being, I try to embrace life fully each and every day. I hope that I will leave this world a little bit better than I found it. And at the same time, I can't wait for this hell to end. Because on that day, at that moment, I too will finally know what it is to be free.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you,
Ralph Remington. The
Thank
book
you.
Is Penetrating Whiteness, How White Supremacy Built America.
Thank you.
Thank you. This is Patricia Welch, Librarian Emeritus, signing off.
O.B. Hill.
Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman, saying I'll see you next month.